today on CityCast Denver. When it comes to homelessness, Denver seems to be out of ideas. Or maybe there are too many ideas, or maybe just not the right ones. Denverites looked outward for answers this week. First to Houston, where an astonishing 25,000 people have been housed in the past decade. And then to a radical idea that's been percolating on the far left for years. So today, we invited our pal, Connor McCormick Cavanaugh, who reports on housing and homelessness for Westward, to put these two ideas side by side and ask, what would help our unhoused neighbors more? Housing first or cash? Today is Friday, September 23rd, 2022. I'm Bree Davies, and this is CityCast Denver.
I love that I'm reading such a Paul intro about pizza.
Do you want me to do it?
I can do it. It's definitely your writing.
Yeah.
Okay. Are we good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Welcome back to CityCast Denver, the show about a city with wildly underrated pizza. That is not my original thought.
Couldn't agree more, Bree.
That's Paul's thought. It's Friday. We're back in the Lindy Zimmer studio at Westward talking about the news of the week. I'm here with my producer, Paul Caroli.
Hey, Bree.
And we're here with Westward staff writer and CityCast Denver contributor, Connor McCormick Cavanaugh.
Thanks for having me.
So before we jump into the serious stuff, next week is unofficially Pizza Week, as we've declared here at CityCast Denver. And
heck yes.
I don't know if you have any clue who's behind this push for Pizza Week, but it's not me.
Exciting.
It is exciting.
We're getting into the spirit of it.
No, absolutely. I'm actually curious to see what we find out.
Me too.
I really don't know. I don't know much about the pizza landscape other than what I've learned from you.
Well, here's what I hope happens. A descent into insanity where we all come out sort of like changed and having learned about the deepest, darkest corners of this city's pizza ovens.
Oh, Paul. Connor, do you have a hot pizza take?
I think it's a beautiful food.
You're an East Coaster.
Same with Connor. That was lovely. Keep going with this.
I just think it's a beautiful food. I eat it pretty often just because it gets the job done, and it's just delicious. And like the sensory experience associated with pizza, especially when it's fresh out of the oven and hot, and it's a whole pie that's made fresh for you, and the cheese is melting, and you really get to kind of experience the idiosyncrasies of a specific pizza type. It's beautiful.
Wow, you're just like speaking Paul's language.
I love it. Insane. That was it. Pizza inspires the mind. It gets you to think in new ways.
Maybe this is how a lot of us feel about burritos.
I think so.
I think that's what I'm feeling, because I don't have this passion for pizza. Not that I don't love it. I'm also a cold pizza person. Are you guys cold pizza people?
Not really.
Okay.
There's never any left.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm also not a leftovers person, but pizza I'll do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we want to hear from you. We want your hottest pizza take. You can leave us a voicemail with your name and neighborhood, and you might hear it on the show next week. Our number is 720-500-5418. Now that we've got our pizza business out of the way, we're going to talk about two stories this week that showed off exactly where Denver is when it comes to housing and homelessness. So there was this trip to Houston last week, a delegation of elected officials from Denver, the Denver Metro, I'm sorry, because this was Denver and Aurora, flew to Houston on sort of a fact-finding trip because Houston has, according to the New York Times, successfully moved 25,000 people off the streets and into homes in the last 10 years. Connor, can you tell me about that trip in particular for our elected officials?
Yeah, so it was a trip that was organized by the city of Aurora, actually, which is interesting because I had originally just assumed that Denver would have organized it, but Aurora is up to some pretty innovative stuff, even if their politics sometimes seem chaotic.
I was going to say, I feel the push and pull of like Mike Kaufman, the mayor, doing the sort of cosplaying homelessness stunt. That did not go well. But then there's some very progressive folks on council that want to do something different.
I mean, to his credit, Mike Kaufman went on this trip and there were two other Aurora City Council members, two Denver City Council members, and then two Denver Metro County Commissioners who went on the trip. And then there were some other staffers from Denver, like the mayor's deputy chief of staff, Evan Dreyer. And so they were going to Houston to on a fact-finding mission, because this article in the New York Times had come out over the summer that was very laudatory of the way that Houston has handled homelessness and housing. And there's an example at the beginning where they're talking about kind of dismantling an encampment in Houston. And the big thing is there were really no issues with the residents of that encampment, because they were all put into housing, transitional housing or permanent supportive housing immediately. And so there was no kind of clashing or where am I going to go or kicking the can down the road.
And which is what's been happening in Denver for 10 years straight.
Absolutely.
For 10 years straight. Like constant conflicts,
like
on the street
corners
downtown.
You can't go
downtown,
home because you don't have a home, but you can't stay here.
Almost every day. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just everyone agrees this is the problem.
I've watched it happen out in front of my house this week, actually. A gentleman was parked his RV. Someone called the police. It wasn't us. And they showed up right away. So I don't know what the option would be for him. So that's a great point, Paul. So yeah, so they went to Houston to see how it's done.
To see how it's done, to talk with service providers there, to talk with politicians there. They did a site visit of a soon-to-be-finished navigation center that's being built in a former charter school. But then the majority of the time they spent in Houston City Hall just meeting with folks and hearing what's worked. And I reached out to a bunch of the different folks who went on the trip, and I said, hey, what are your lessons learned? And a big one is that Denver Metro really needs to cooperate on homelessness as a region and not have kind of isolated cities and municipalities working on this issue. It has to be a team effort. So it's not just a Denver issue. It's not just an Aurora issue, but everyone has to get on board with this. And we've heard ideas of this for a long time. You know, decades ago, it used to be just viewed as, oh, that's a Denver problem. So if there were people experiencing homelessness in Centennial or Englewood or even Aurora, those folks were just assumed to be Denver's homeless population. And so there was no kind of motivation to help out in that regard. But people are starting to evolve in their mindset. And there seems to be good buy-in for doing a region-wide approach. Now, while there's buy-in, it's you have to actually do it. And so that's what we need to follow going forward.
I'm so, so dubious of this region-wide approach. Like, not that it's not a good idea, but I was just reading this morning about this story that I had remembered a few weeks ago out of Douglas County. You know, a region-wide approach requires the whole region to get on board. Douglas County
not going to want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah, I mean,
they've actively said that.
I hadn't seen that, but
I
believe
that
you.
They don't. It's just not something that they're going to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was talking. The story I read, their last thing they did was they put people experiencing homelessness into cars. They paid for cars to just drive them to other parts of the metro. Hancock complained about this. Kaufman complained about this. Like, I don't think that's a good basis for a relationship that could evolve into this Houston model here. I don't know. That's just one problem, though. There's a lot to talk about.
No, you're 100% right. If we think about Denver Metro, Douglas County would definitely be the outlier in any cooperation on this. For years, they've contributed next to nothing on this issue in terms of a financial footprint. And you listen to what the politicians there say, and they generally don't seem, they wouldn't, I can't imagine they'd be super eager to get involved on this matter the same way that a Denver or an Englewood or a Centennial now or an Aurora would. They very much view this as not their problem. And I think they'd be quite happy if there was homelessness to exist, that it wasn't in Douglas County at all.
Yeah, it's such a NIMBY and political problem in viewing it this way, because human beings don't adhere to geographical, you know what I mean? Like, you don't you're not like, well, I guess I'm not homeless because I live in Douglas County. Like, it just doesn't, it doesn't jive with the realities. And I appreciated from the New York Times article about Houston, like, this was the main thing that they did, was they broke down those barriers and said, we have to work together or it's not going to work. And I'm always skeptical of articles that say like, oh, look, this thing solved homelessness. And I don't think they necessarily characterized it that way, but it's easy to mm-hmm. look from the outside and say something has done. Like, I think Salt Lake yeah. City had a similar PR situation a couple of years ago. Like, we've solved homelessness, and people working on the ground were like, well, we haven't, but we've done a lot. And so I guess I was skeptical of this trip because I don't know. I got plenty out of that article. What did they? Do you know what they saw, Connor? Was you know? Did Councilman Hines or Councilwoman Sathebaca say anything like revelatory in what they got out of their trip?
Councilman Hines told me something that was very interesting, and it kind of goes to your point of, did they have to go to Houston to figure this out? One of the slides that they got in a PowerPoint presentation there said that Houston got its inspiration for the way that it kind of started working on homelessness from Denver's Road Home, which Whoa. Is
which yeah. was the Hickenlooper era plan to end
homelessness,
right?
Yeah.
This
10-year plan to end homelessness. And again, I mean, that was the 10-year plan to end homelessness was a tagline that the federal government asked mayors to do across the country. It wasn't Hickenlooper who came up with this idea, although
sure, no, fair. It just his this was
sure.
the era.
This was the era. No, but it was a Hickenlooper project, mm-hmm. the Denver's Road Home, and it obviously didn't get Denver home. It had some positive elements, and one of the big ones was getting entities that worked on homelessness in Denver to collaborate better, get out of their silos. And, you know, because there's competition for funding. There's essentially competition for like what specific areas people work on. So these service providers haven't always been super cooperative among each other.
I mean, they have different ideologies too. Like
different
some
ideologies.
Are very rooted in faith-based communities.
Sure.
And some are feel the opposite, like that has no place in this system.
Yeah.
And that's like a huge barrier for some people.
Volunteers of America, that's an offshoot of the Salvation Army because they disagreed over philosophy many years ago. And so Denver's Road Home was successful in bringing folks together, but then they kind of, it didn't last for a long time. And that program was not well funded mm-hmm. at all.
Well, and I just want to say this, Denver's Road Home was rolled out in 2005. Were you guys here in 2005?
No.
Okay. Like, it breaks my heart. And I'm sure that people working on housing and homelessness issues still from that time are equally frustrated because it was a different city then. It may have felt even more like we could tackle it. Like there's a little bit of frustration thinking about the opportunity that we had at that time mm-hmm. and how we maybe have bungled it.
Yeah, it does feel like insurmountable now. It feels
yeah.
like a really
oh my
really
God, it
problem.
Feels like, yeah, it feels like a problem that is continually being fed by you know, a housing market that's unattainable, and you know what I mean? Things that were not the problems of 2005.
Can we talk about this other thing that Houston is doing differently? So there's the unifying all these organizations into this one continuum that we don't have, but then they also have really put a priority on what they call a housing first model. How is that different from what we're doing, Connor?
So it's, I mean, in terms of rhetoric, it's no different from what Denver is doing. Denver talks, the mayor talks, Britta Fisher, the head of the Department of Housing Stability, they talk how Denver is housing first. It's this idea that rather than requiring people living on the streets or in shelters to get a job or kick an addiction before they can start accessing housing, the idea is to give them housing, help them connect them with housing first, and then people have a much better chance of figuring out those other difficult things in life, like getting a job if you haven't worked for a while or kicking a tough addiction. And Denver's been talking about this. We had the social impact bond program a few years ago where it was a housing first program, and it had really positive results. And we saw people being a lot more successful when Denver used a housing first approach. But Denver doesn't have a truly housing first approach because there isn't enough housing. There isn't enough deeply affordable housing that's, you know, less than 30% of the area median income. So given that it doesn't have enough affordable housing, when sweeps are happening, it's not a housing first approach. There's no, hey, we're going to dismantle your encampment and here's a unit to go into. That it's not that. It's just like we were talking about before, kind of moving people around.
But you're touching on the thing that I think is the biggest issue, one of the biggest issues here. It's very complicated, but that we don't have the housing. And I feel like Councilwoman Seda Baca has talked about that aspect. It's like, when are we going to force some affordability in this private market? Like, how is that going to happen? Because so far, it hasn't. And again, 2005 Denver, there was so much housing. I know. I lived in apartments at that time. It was a very different landscape. But how could we even implement something like Houston's model if we don't have anywhere to house people?
Well, that's where I got to when I was reading the article. And then I kind of turned a corner when I saw a comment that Chris Hines made to our pal Chris Walker at 5280 about this question of, like, what's the real problem? Is it housing? Housing too expensive? Where's the quote-unquote affordable housing? Like, okay, so here's what Chris Hines said. He was recounting a conversation with Houston's homeless czar, and this person apparently said, housing includes three things. So when they're saying housing first, they mean three things: the housing, the funding for the housing, and the funding for supportive services. He said you have to have all three legs of the stool for the stool to stand up. And I thought that was interesting because, and this is Hines saying this, because when people think of housing, they often think of the structure, not necessarily the funding streams related to it. So I think maybe the issue here is that we've been focusing a little too much on the affordability of the units and not enough on finding the money to pay what it costs, whatever it costs. And it's more about our values and our choice to dedicate that funding stream, to actually recognize housing as a right, to recognize this model works, and make that choice.
There's a lot of money in this city, and maybe that's part of the problem. We're just not directing it to the things that are needed, which is to build a housing at whatever it costs, like you're saying, Paul. Like, yeah. We can't change the cost of supplies. We can't change the cost of labor. We have to do something. And what is that?
Two interesting things in the mayor's budget, and this is with American Rescue Plan Act money from the federal government. One, it's about $20 million to purchase a motel and transform it into supportive housing units, which is a great use of pandemic relief money, because that money is not going to repeat itself. It's kind of a one-time thing, so it makes sense to do a one-time purchase. And then there's another one that's also around $20 million to purchase a motel and turn that into a transitional center for people experiencing homelessness, kind of what Houston is almost done building right now in the former charter school and where the politicians visited. It's this idea of you can get people from encampments to this transitional center, and then they're in there. They have kind of a more dignifying, sheltering situation for a short period of time, and then you can get them into housing. So those are two purchases, hopefully, that are coming in the near future.
Well, and I also do want to say, it's not to say that those things aren't also happening. It's just, like, not enough, you know?
Oh, it's, I'm thinking about, dropping the pond.
You know? Yeah, like, it's not that there aren't affordable housing developers out there trying to do that. It's not that the city isn't doing it in some capacity. It's just not enough.
Winding through the canyon, her anticipation rose. Monarch Casino Resort Spa, the epitome of mountain chic. Her pulse raced as she sat down at a high-limit baccarat table. Hungry? She chose the Southwest fusion flavors of Bistro Mariposa before ascending to Bliss, a top-rated spa Monarch, for a signature massage treatment. She slept well in her luxurious hotel room, fulfilled by her stay. Write your own story at monarchblackhawk.com.
Must be 21. Gambling problem? Call or text 1-800-GAMBLER.
So I want to move on to this second story that really intertwines with this conversation about housing, which is the Denver Basic Income Project kind of blew up into a national story. So it started out, how would you characterize how it started? It was a nonprofit venture?
I think it started with
a rich guy who said,
twinkle in Elon Musk's eye that there should be electric cars. And then this guy named Mark Donovan decided to invest in Tesla before it went to the moon over the pandemic. He made a boatload of money and started feeling really guilty. And he saw this homelessness problem in Denver and thought, what do I do? What do I do with all of this enormous wealth I've acquired? And he decided to give it away. $1,000 a month to 10 people. I don't know how he met these people, but he just started giving it away.
He's just a private person in the world that said, I want to try this thing.
Yeah. And I just think this is crazy that this is now a City of Denver authorized program and that's how it started. But yeah.
No, yeah, it is. It's a pretty wild story. I mean, Mark Donovan lived for a while in Bali in Southeast Asia, and he had a clothing company that he made that was his career for a while. And then he's making money during the pandemic, the early months of the pandemic, off his stock. He's living in Denver. And yeah, like he had this realization like, hey, you know, I should probably give back to the world. And so he got this idea of kind of giving people stipends or basic income each month. And he went public with his project in June 2021. And he seems to be quite good at fundraising, and he's brought a bunch of different partners on board, and it's grown and grown and grown. And so now DU researchers, University of Denver researchers, are involved, and there's going to be a very strong research component to it. And so he's raised millions of dollars too, and now there's going to be over 800 people who are going to be involved in this Denver Basic Income Project. The city of Denver is getting involved too, providing $2 million. And that money is specifically earmarked for women, both cisgender and transgender, and families. And I asked the city why they specifically chose those populations. And they said because they've been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic in terms of homelessness in Denver, which I thought was a valid enough response to justify it. And so, but the entire project is open to more than just those populations. So it's open to people experiencing homelessness, living in shelters, on the streets. Two things that are disqualifying factors is if you have substance use
issues
or severe untreated mental health issues, you cannot participate in the program. So you can't receive money. But it's going to be 260 people get, or maybe we should just explain what basic income
is.
Yeah,
I think that's really important because people really will important. See this UBI thing floating around, and it's one of those things that is just like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, so I mean, UBI, Universal Basic Income, is this idea that the floor of people's incomes across the country should universally be higher than it is now. So if you have a universal basic income, you're kind of lifting everyone's floor. And Andrew Yang, when he was running for president this past presidential election cycle, he was one of his big campaign issues was UBI. He wanted to implement a UBI. And we've seen UBI kind of be implemented. It's obviously not universal when it's implemented in these smaller projects. A certain amount of money each month was implemented in Vancouver as part of the New Leaf Project, and it had really positive results. And so, the Denver Basic Income Project is essentially exploring and researching. We're going to give people X amount of money each month. These people are living on the streets or in shelters or in their cars. They're homeless. And we want to see how this impacts their lives. What are the positive benefits? Are they able to secure housing more easily? Are they able to pay a down payment or I guess a deposit it would be for a rental unit because that can be tough sometimes. Are they able to more easily apply for a job just because they have a bit more stability?
And the difference in this approach, I think it's important to note, is this is putting cash assistance in the hands of folks to make decisions for themselves about what they need, right? So it's not like, you know, you have to go to a food bank to get food or apply through a program to get a voucher to do a, what, you know, whatever, get a navigator to get you into the system to get this, you know, maybe you just need new glasses. You know what I mean? Like, not that, like, you know, the Stout Street Clinic isn't doing amazing things there and stuff, but this idea is like, just give people money to take care of the stuff that they need. And so I just wanted to make that clear so folks understand that this is like pretty radical when you think about a government saying, we're just going to give folks, you know, a check every month.
It's pretty radical for the U.S. especially. I mean, this is so not what we've done as a country, at least in recent history. And so, yeah, it's money, no strings attached.
Well, Paul, when we were talking about this story earlier before recording, I feel like you had an interesting reaction to this idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I feel a little bit like personally touched by this whole story because, you know, I see Mark Donovan, fellow white guy moving around Denver, seeing the same things I'm seeing. I also early on in the pandemic had that moment where I realized this is going to affect other people way more than it's going to affect me. What can I do? Is there anything I can do? You know, and at the time, my wife was working for the city and she got redeployed to one of the temporary shelters that was being set up for people experiencing homelessness. So she saw what was going on, and what was going on was there was chaos. It was not enough help, not enough of anything. No one knew what was going on. People were all scared. People were being taken advantage of. Just a horrible situation. And then because I'm on the St. Francis Center newsletter, they're a day shelter downtown, I saw they put out a call. They said, all of our usual volunteers are elderly, and so they're staying home. And our staff just had an outbreak, so we have no one to work the shelter. Is there anyone that can come help? And that was late March 2020. So ever since then, I've been going in every week, a little bit less frequently lately. And I actually just decided to stop doing it. But that was my response to the pandemic. And I feel like this Mark Donovan guy had his own, and it was like embraced by the city. But for me, my experience of engaging with this topic at this horrible time was the total opposite. It was like, I'm now afraid of paternalism more than anything. Like, I read about this Housing First policy in Houston, and I got really excited because it takes the shelters, it flips the power dynamic, you know? The UBI thing is appealing for the same reasons, but I think if we have data that the Houston model works, we need to really try as best we can to avoid that paternalism. Because you see it every day in the shelter. You see people get taken advantage of. You see people get pushed down, pushed around.
What do you mean by paternalism in this sense?
I think it'd be helpful if I offered an example.
Yes.
So the way that the storage system works, St. Francis Center offers space. There's a room where you can put your stuff. So that's cool. You know, that's a great resource for people. It's because people get stuff stolen all the time, like constantly. The way it works is you have to be there at 9 a.m. when the person is available for 15 minutes to sign you up for a storage space. You have to sign a contract. You have to be escorted back to the room and out of the room. You have to be diligent about updating your storage space.
It's a lot of
management.
There's
so many rules. There's so much management. It's really hard to get it right because you're living on the street. Like, things come up. Sometimes you miss a deadline, and then what? You lose all of your clothes, your winter clothes, your winter coat. Then you have to get a new one. It's just like all of these systems that we make people interact with, we just process people through, they're just creating problems. Like, they're just compounding problems. And when people rely on them, they get stuck.
I think the optics of a rich man who made money in the early stages of the pandemic off Tesla stock and is now wanting to have the revelation of, I want to do good, I want to give away this money. I could understand kind of where you struggle with the, like, that's paternalism, because I think it really could be. I think the way that the Denver Basic Income Project has evolved has taken away a lot of that. It's become less like it's not a cult of personality, like, nonprofit project now. It's like a very kind of robust, and it seems like somewhat horizontal consistently kind of governed structure now. That seems like a pretty legit nonprofit project structure. And so who knows? I'm not, you know, in their meetings, but I think that paternalistic element has been taken away a little bit. And I think there is, of course, something with, you know, helping people living on the streets with all these different services could come across as paternalistic. But then I think the flip side of that is giving people money and letting them kind of get back the autonomy in their lives is kind of the opposite. Or maybe it's almost the opposite.
Autonomy is a great way to look at it, too. It's something we really take for granted when we don't have to worry about stuff.
Yeah,
for sure. You make your own decisions. You decide when you eat. You decide when you go to bed. You decide where you put your, you know what I mean? You don't have to like do all of this like hyper management of every moment of your life. That like, if we had to do all that on top of what we're doing every day, I would be stressed out too. I don't understand how folks handle it. I really can't imagine what that's like.
Yeah.
I'm thankful every day that I'm not in like an institutional setting, like a homeless shelter or a jail or prison or some sort of setting like that, where you really don't have
Autonomy.
Any autonomy.
But I think that's also why it's so crucial that those of us that have that societal autonomy, talk about what we need to change,
mm-hmm.
because we have the power to change it. And I think that's I hear the struggle with this like rich guy does well thing, but also like, I don't know, how do we just redistribute wealth then?
Well, I don't know. What if we put these two stories up against each other? You know, how do we see the basic income project in the context of a housing first model, or like what that could look like in Denver? Because I don't know how well I think it fits.
I think it works great together personally. Like, give someone housing, okay, then so much good stuff comes from housing that we don't think about. Like this, it's the housing first approach is opposite of these things that say, get your shit together before we give you this. And I think there was a great metaphor for this in the Houston story in the New York Times. It said, it's like a person is drowning and you go out and you say, well, I'm going to teach you how to swim first. I'm not going to save you.
Yeah,
and it's like, that's kind of how it is. So to me, if we can do housing first, get folks in a home and then give them a little bit of money, they could start to figure out the things that they need to take care of and prioritize, just like all of us that are housed do already. And then I think it could, I don't know. I see them working together. But Paul, I think you're very
I'm conflicted about the UBI part, because I think that, I mean, there's another quote from Hines about Mayor Kaufman on this Houston trip that I think is worthwhile. Hines was describing like what Kaufman was curious about and how he was interacting with the Houston officials. Chris Hines told Chris Walker at 5280 that Mayor Kaufman asked a lot of questions about jobs. And the homeless czar in Houston kept driving home the point that they had only one metric, taking someone without a home and putting them into a home.
So I reached out to the city of Aurora to see if I could kind of get some reactions from Mayor Kaufman. And they pointed me in the direction of, they said, did you see his Facebook post? So I looked at his Facebook post about it. He's very good about posting on Twitter and Facebook all his thoughts. And he said he was very intrigued by this kind of more collaborative approach, but he's still very skeptical of the housing first idea and model. And he said that he had asked about these metrics and he wasn't satisfied with the answer. So yeah, I mean, maybe Mayor Kaufman is just not gonna ever be into the housing first model.
He's really a bootstraps guy.
Yeah, I don't know.
Something else I wanted to talk, we're talking about the politics of this, with the UBI, with Denver, the city of Denver embracing this idea. Connor, I have to say I'm a little skeptical that Mayor Hancock on his way out is like, this sounds great. Like, this feels like one last good PR push to me, if I'm being extremely cynical, as I tend to be with him. What do you think about that, this timing?
I mean, I'm super cynical of politicians too, just because when you cover politics, the only natural way to view politics and politicians is from a cynical perspective. But I think Hancock is evolving on homelessness and housing in his last term as mayor, kind of very late. In his third term, he mentioned when he did a State of the City speech a couple months ago, he essentially admitted that sweeps were just kicking the can down the road and weren't really achieving anything, which I was kind of struck by him admitting that publicly. And then, I mean, even if this is part of his motivation is for this good PR, it's like,
okay,
whatever. I mean, that's
whatever gets the job done.
That's a lot of politicians, the work that they do in a nutshell. It's good PR, makes them look good, makes them a viable candidate in the future. So, yeah.
No, I feel you. It's like, okay, well, if that is what it is, fine. But at least we're getting universal basic income out of it. Paul, what do you think?
I think he's scoring points. It's like a short-term win, and he doesn't have to deal with the consequences.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't think this is a problem that you solve with these, like, limited-run, like, poorly funded programs.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard a lot of great stories about people who have got a lot out of these safe outdoor spaces we've been talking about the last couple years, but...
Yeah.
It's, like, not the scale to make a real difference, and it's like... The small shiny thing to look at that chips away at the actual big consistent funding stream you need to house people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm looking at for politicians, you know, coming up in the next election. I want to hear people brave enough to be unpopular, to not talk about the list of all these smaller but maybe exciting new ideas to try and someone to take a hard line. This is the way.
That's like, going to be really tough, Paul. I just think again about working on a campaign for a candidate that actively knew she was not going to win, but her agenda was to push ideas like that. And I worry that those radical ideas that could really change something are not going to be popular enough with the candidates that have the financial backing to get the word out to get elected. But you brought up safe outdoor spaces. Connor, you've covered these quite a bit. What do you think, how do they function when we look at something like Housing First? Like, where do they fit into the equation?
Well, I think with these projects like safe outdoor spaces and this universal basic income project, or not universal, just this basic income project, they're kind of like large scale pilot projects.
Yeah.
And It's putting first foot in the water. And so with safe outdoor spaces, they seem to make sense to a lot of the service providers right now, but none of them are saying, oh, this is our solution to homelessness. Safe outdoor spaces hopefully will be replaced maybe in the next 5 years, 10 years, just by housing.
Yeah.
And so there won't be a need for people staying in these ice fishing tents or now these upgraded units, these pallet shelters. Hopefully we don't need those at all, because it's way more dignifying for someone to be in those than it is to be getting harassed by people on the streets or cops or neighbors just living in a tent or living in a tarp. But it's way more dignifying to live actually in, you know, four walls and a
Absolutely.
Roof over your head than it is in an ice fishing tent or a pallet shelter. So hopefully they become a thing of the past, not because they don't work, because it sounds like there's some really positive stories, but just because we won't need them.
Yeah. I mean, I was skeptical at first of safe outdoor spaces because I felt like, why can't we just house people? But it's what we have and it's what we can do right now. And if we talk about how expensive it is to build housing, at least we can make it a little bit safer for folks to be free from harassment. I think that's the best point to me, Connor, is at least folks are free from harassment.
And they can go to the bathroom.
They go to the bathroom, right.
And shower and do wash their face and
do all the basic things.
And chill. Like,
yeah.
People deserve the right to sleep in sometimes and go to bed early or just relax.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paul, Connor, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Bree.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks.
That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. Our producers this week were Paul Caroli, Aaron O'Toole, and Lizzie Goldsmith. Peyton Garcia writes our morning newsletter. I'm your host, Bree Davies. Our music is by Los Mocochetes with additional mixing by Tyler Lindgren. If you haven't already, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at CityCast Denver and tell Mike Kaufman about us next time you see him. You can sign up for our daily newsletter and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. Bye.